Hi, welcome to the China Unscripted podcast. I'm your host, Chris Chappell.
I'm Shelley Zhang.
And I'm Matt Ganesda.
And I just want to remind everyone, be sure to check us out on ChinaUnscripted.com and leave us a five-star review on iTunes. It really helps the show out. So, joining us today is a good friend of the show, Ethan Gutman. Ethan, please say hello and tell us a little bit about yourself.
Hello. As I said, my name's Ethan Gutman, and I'm a writer and investigative author on the organ harvesting issue in China, and have been for some years.
You know, I think I just heard that Gutman actually means good man. Do you think that describes you?
That's the German interpretation of Gutman.
Is there another interpretation?
Not really, actually. It's a German name, so we'll just leave it there.
Okay.
I think that's probably correct, and I do spell it with two N's, not with two T's, which makes it more like Buttman.
Ethan Buttman.
Thanks. I know. That's you wouldn't believe how many times people spell it that way.
Really?
Anyways, yeah, it's very common. Okay.
Is that taking you back to some childhood memories?
Well, it's like what did Muhammad Ali said? They can call me Cassius. They can call me Ali. I don't care what they call me.
you don't have his left hook to back you up.
No, though. I really don't. so, anyways, that's where we're at with the name. It's no big deal. It's just the name.
Okay. Well, we're already talking about really important issues right now.
So it's a German name, but you're joining us from London, and you've also lived in China for some time.
Yeah, I am joining you from London in Covent Garden, where the London, the independent tribunal into forced organ harvesting in China is taking place right now.
Oh, what's that?
Well, that is something we've been kind of working on or trying to suggest for some years now, because basically every time we go to Congress or the European Parliament or whatever, they often say, this is really important. We believe this is a true issue. It's really happening and so forth. And gee, wouldn't it be great if there was sort of an independent tribunal which would, evaluate all the evidence very carefully and come out with a finding on it. And so that's what's finally happening. Now, that is not, in my egotistic world, I sort of imagine, well, I wrote a book on this, so what more needs to be said?
But, we have so much in common. I made an episode about this. What more needs to be said?
Exactly. But apparently most people don't feel that way, and they'd like to hear it from a number of sources, and I think that's perfectly fair. It is being chaired by Jeffrey Niess, who was the lead, I believe, prosecutor or investigator on Kosovo. So he's quite famous with human rights cases. Very, very serious guy, and I think they're running a very tight ship here. So,
great. Well, congratulations. I'm glad that's finally come about.
I'm looking forward to testifying tomorrow. Yeah.
Great. And just so everyone knows, this podcast will be released after the tribunal has wrapped up, so be sure to read up all about it.
Yeah, so it's already old news, right?
Mm-hmm.
The world will have changed once the tribunal. We'll see. Now, the reason why it's appropriate to talk about it no matter what is because the tribunal probably doesn't end after 3 days. They will probably go in session again and probably follow some more leads that come out of it. So, and that will happen in January or February and so forth.
And also, you can read Ethan's latest book, which is called The Slaughter, and we'll put a link next to the video or below the video where you can check that out.
Yes, and you can also, if you're listening to this and your native tongue is Chinese, you can read it in Mandarin. It has just come out in Mandarin.
Oh, is it a big seller in China?
It's doing well. It's a big seller in Taiwan. It's in complex characters, though I expect we may see a simplified character version floating around at some point.
But that one in mainland China, it's more of a how-to guide.
Oh my goodness, that's a low blow.
I apologize on behalf of Matt. I'll understand if you want to wrap up right now.
The point is, yes, it is selling very well in Taiwan. And they say there's a very high awareness of this issue now in Taiwan. as high an awareness of Chinese human rights as there was during Tiananmen Square.
Oh, that's great.
So I think that is really good. It may have dovetailed into the election, but the bottom line is, nothing in Asia happens without a certain amount of discomfort or embarrassment.
Does this come from your years of experience living in Asia?
Yes, it does. Yes, it does come from my years of experience. It was always what I recommended when I was a business consultant there. I said, you're not going to get anywhere with your partners by just being perfectly polite and doing everything the right way and leaving your chopsticks just so. And that, it's you really, really do have to get down to the nitty-gritty. And you do have to do this, okay? You're actually more uncomfortable about it than they are.
I had read your book, Losing the New China, when it came out. That was a long time ago.
That's right.
And you had lived in China for how many years?
Just 3 years, not that long.
But you had observed quite quite a lot about sort of how the business world works there.
That is true, but there was a tremendous amount of resentment among expats when I came out with that book.
Oh, I can imagine, because you told people how things actually were.
Well, there was that, but there was also the fact that a lot of people said, well, I've been here 30 years. What are you doing writing a book after 3 years? And I said, well, why don't you write 10 books then? You've been here 30 years.
Oh, burn.
It's a burn and also kind of a math joke.
Well, so first of all, that book was written in 2004, Losing the New China.
That's right.
By the way, did you ever find the new China?
I think we're finding out what the new China is right now.
It's usually in the last place you left it.
No, it's not in this case. It's moving quickly, isn't it?
Uh-huh. Well, that was like 15 years ago. So surely American businesses have learned how to do business in China and hold the Communist Party to task now, right?
Well, without getting this into a conversation about the Trump administration or administration policies.
Thank you.
You have to, yeah, exactly. Thank you. You have to notice the business community has been doing a little bit of lobbying here and there, and can you call off the trade war a bit or something? But it's nothing compared to the reaction you would have gotten, you would have received back in 2002 or 2003, right?
What do you mean?
The China lobby, the business lobby of the ultimate China lobby was American business back then. Mm. And they really, really would go out and fight very hard and lobby very hard, as they did to get China into WTO.
WTF.
And so forth. That's not really happening, at least not on the same scale anymore. Hmm. There is a exhaustion, for a better lack of a better word. I mean, there's a fatigue out there about China and the way a lot of expats have been treated.
Hmm.
Is it about the treatment of people or the way that Chinese authorities are treating businesses?
It's a combination of those factors. But look at the amount of Westerners who've been thrown into prison. I mean, I just saw one of them today, an old friend from Beijing, Peter Humphrey, used to be head of Kroll Associates in Beijing. He was a drinking buddy. We used to hang out. He was in prison for quite some time. Hmm. I just caught up with him recently here. He's trying to get CCTV, China Central Television, shut down in England, because one of the things they did was show his forced confession on TV in England.
Oh, yes. Wow. I was reading about that campaign.
Yeah, yeah. It's a very compelling point. They really did this. And he's also talked about how they do it, right? And how they do a forced confession, exactly how they... It's as elaborate as, putting together a McDonald's hamburger for photography or something.
Just as nutritious.
So we have a lot of these. Yeah, we have a lot of. There's a lot of resentment and mixed emotions about China, and a loss of faith that China really, really will ever be an open economy.
Hmm. Well, so on that topic, I know you have been writing about the Chinese Communist Party for a number of years, and the Chinese Communist Party is still there. How do you feel? What keeps you going?
Well, that's, you know, I've been losing for two decades now. You know, it's like, you know, come on. You know, do I, you know, play the game, enjoy the game? You know, they can't get me off the chessboard, mm-hmm. right? That's, and that.
Don't hate the game.
Well, you know, I don't. And the point is, it's like it's an endless series. Fighting China is an endless series of Dunkirk operations.
that doesn't fill me with hope.
Well,
but ultimately, Dunkirk was successful. Pretty much,
it was a successful retreat.
A successful retreat.
Did it work out in the end?
Yeah, did it work out in the end? Yeah, we beat them. Yeah, that's right. All those soldiers came back in Normandy and went to Berlin.
Oh, nice! I'm looking forward to the sequel. Like, I wonder if somebody is going to do something about that Nazi Germany.
there was a movie about that. I think it was called Inglourious Basterds.
Oh, yeah. We can't recommend it because it's rated R, and we have, I assume, younger viewers who... Anyways. So, here's a question. The Chinese Communist Party has persecuted a lot of groups. Which is your favorite?
Of the groups? That's mean. I can't do that. That's like saying, who do you prefer in the Holocaust? You know, gypsies or Romanies? I mean, I can't do that.
Oh, gypsies all the way.
Gypsies, Romanies, Jews. I mean, you know, I can't say one group is. Every group has their. You really want an answer? Every group has their advantages. With the Uyghurs, I can have a lot of drinks. There's nothing like talking strategy with. Nothing that compares with a Chinese practitioner Falun Gong. Though they're drinking, you can't have a drink with them.
But you can eat pork with them.
You can eat pork, indeed. And actually, you can eat pork with most Uyghur Muslims, too. Oh. Which is one of the reasons why the Muslim community is not so... I mean, it doesn't excuse them, but one of the reasons why the Muslim community is not taking them all that seriously or deciding not to make an issue of them.
Because they're not,
they're not
serious.
They're not so extreme... that they, you know, want to keep halal, but they are so extreme that they're an extraordinary threat to the stability of China. Is that right?
Well, they are perceived. That is correct. That's a really good way of putting it. I mean, they are. I don't know that they're really seen as a real threat to the stability of China. I'm not sure about that. My assumption is this is more about energy. All of China's energy is supposed to come from that region, Xinjiang.
You mean like natural resources kind of energy?
Exactly. Fracking.
Not ginseng kind of energy.
Not ginseng kind of energy. And not. No, it's seriously, this is the place where China is, this is what they're depending on. Mm-hmm. And they see the Uyghurs as standing in the way.
Yeah. It's critical for the Belt and Road Initiative.
Absolutely, it's the jumping off point. So I think from that perspective, you can sort of, I've been trying to figure out why exactly the Chinese Communist Party has mishandled the Uyghur situation so badly, mm-hmm. And why they've decided that they're going to crush and destroy the language, why they've decided that they are going to, I mean, these are like little Muslim revivals. I don't mean to cast aspersions on the religion in any way, but there is a sort of a tendency when one is in persecution to kind of go back to religious roots and so forth and emphasize them. I understand that. I respect it even. But the point is the Chinese would have done a lot better by handing over some candy and flowers instead of just sticks.
I wouldn't trust candy from a Communist Party official.
Well, fair enough. That's one of the problems, I suppose. Yeah. In fact, that's what they keep claiming, is we have given you candy and flowers. We built all this infrastructure. Look at these sparkling new hospitals, with these huge transplant centers. I mean, this is really, you know.
The mostly empty city. So,
are there new transplant centers in Xinjiang?
Oh, yes.
Haven't
you seen that picture of the special in Kashgar airport? There is a special line that is for nothing but human organs.
Oh, well, so since you mentioned that, there's evidence that the whole forced organ harvesting began with Uyghurs in Xinjiang.
You wrote, that's the first chapter of your book.
Mm-hmm. That's what I said in the first chapter. But we don't know that. I mean, what we know is that that's the first witnesses we've got to live organ harvesting, and to the first witnesses we have to political prisoners or religious prisoners being harvested comes from that region. Now, it's also true that there's a case way back in the 70s, the late 70s, but that was, I've never included that because it was kind of a late Cultural Revolution effect where they took a dissident, a very beautiful woman, if I remember correctly, and cut her open while she was still alive and pulled out her organs or pulled out her kidneys and did transplant one, but it wasn't successful. And the whole thing looks to me sort of as a just one of the sort of pure Maoist excess, not a sort of a serious operation.
Not a systemic thing.
Not a systemic thing. That's right. And so I've never really included that. I've always thought of that as kind of an aberration.
Compared to the aberration of the current system.
Right. Well, but it got serious starting in the 90s in Xinjiang.
That's right. But there's this long period where they're only harvesting regular prisoners. And they were doing it fairly, as far as we can tell, during the 80s. It was all fairly, I hate to say it, put it this way, but legal. Okay. At least legal by Chinese standards. They were, you put out an execution order on a prisoner, and that meant that they had to be executed within a week. And they would shoot the prisoner to death, right? And then they'd remove the organs, okay? That is our impression of this all the way up to 92. Around 94, 95, we start getting these reports of live organ harvesting. Okay, so that's a shift. And then the next shift is in 1997, where in Gulja, the Uyghurs have a small, relatively small demonstration, and it's put down by force. And there's a massive, they basically lock the whole city down, and that's when people start disappearing. And suddenly the cemeteries are being patrolled, and nobody's allowed to look at the bodies.
Wow. So it's a shift from killing a prisoner and taking their organs to taking their organs while they're alive to just doing it to anybody the party doesn't like.
That's right. I mean, that wouldn't be enough right there just to say, oh, well, the cemeteries were being patrolled and people were disappearing and you couldn't see the bodies. That's
sure.
Very circumstantial. What we have instead is one witness who I really wish was at this tribunal, but unfortunately, it's very difficult for them to be here because they have family in China. But this was a young doctor. And this young doctor worked in Urumqi, which is the capital of Xinjiang, and he was told by his superior one day, he said, go to the political prisoner wing of the Urumqi prison and start taking blood samples of all the prisoners there. And he said, why? And he said, well, we just need to know the blood types right now. There's six cadres, high-ranking Chinese Communist Party cadres, and they've come to town, they're staying at this in hotel, and they're going to need organs. But you don't need to worry about that. You just need to map out the basics of these, you know, just map it out. And he went there, and it nearly caused a riot, is what he described, because for some reason, I don't know why this didn't happen with Falun Gong practitioners initially. They never were sensitive to it, perhaps because they're Han Chinese. But with the Uyghurs, they went, why are you doing this? You're a Uyghur like us. How can you take blood from us? And he said, oh, it's just for your health. It's just for your health. And they said, no, it's not. You know, I mean, there was a real... they had to hold them down. He took the blood. It's just for your health. It's just for your health.
But they knew better.
They seemed to know better. And in fact, those six cadres got their organs and checked out of the hotel. And then a couple weeks later, six more arrived.
Ah.
So this was the beginning of where we can really say for certain in 1997 that it was beginning to be a real possibility, but you know, the numbers are tiny, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, six people going to Xinjiang and getting some organs, some aging Chinese Communist Party cadres. It's the fact that, and then we stop hearing about it. It kind of disappears. So it looks almost as if that was a kind of aberration. It was sort of out there. And then Falun Gong. Falun Gong is what changed. I mean, in 1999, the persecution of Falun Gong begins in July. And then, you know, you have this massive amount of Falun Gong in prison. I've often estimated 1 million to 1.5 million at that time, at that particular, about 2000, 2001.
Wow.
You're getting these spectacular numbers. You have, you know, diseases spreading in the prisons and labor camps. You had malaria, outbreak of malaria in one. I mean, all these, this is a dysentery. All these things are going on, and they, in this massive crowding, they start to suddenly do these exams, medical exams, and only of the Falun Gong. At that point, nobody else. So the regular prisoners don't get examined. They don't get their blood taken.
Huh.
Just the Falun Gong. And then these exams are also administered in a very strange way. Initially, they were administered with every single Falun Gong practitioner. These are women, okay? Every one of them is given an individual guard who watches over them while the blood is taken. Now, that's unusual. Why would you even do that? That's an incredible expenditure of manpower, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Why do you do that? Well, because you're really nervous. They're going to figure out what's going on. That's my assumption.
Geez. Well, it's funny that you mentioned that, like with the Uyghurs, they knew something was not right. And there was not that case with the Falun Gong.
And I think there was a trust level. Do you think there's a trust level there, Chris? Because, I mean, sort of your Han Chinese, you wouldn't do this to somebody like me.
Well, I think it's more of a fundamental thing of the difference between where Falun Gong was at the time and Uyghurs. Like Uyghurs, they knew they were being persecuted by the Chinese Communist Party. I think a lot of Falun Gong practitioners at the time, and you really see this in the behaviors of the group early on, that they just saw themselves as part of Chinese society. Mm-hmm. That they didn't have this idea that... I think there was like a period where it took time for them to really understand what the party was doing to them, that they really had become the next new group that was going to be persecuted.
Like it was just a mistake.
Yeah, that it could be explained away.
That is really so accurate. I've heard that from so many Falun Gong practitioners over the years, and certainly that was the attitude back then. The whole thing was kind of a mistake. It just needed to be explained. You know, it was some sort of, they're in the middle, they somehow gotten themselves caught in some factional fight. It'll all be over soon. That was the assumption. Mm-hmm. And the Uyghurs never had that kind of closeness to the Communist Party. They didn't have anything with the Communist Party, really. Just a few Quislings who would sort of do the Communist Party's bidding on a local level, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's very accurate. I think, and there was, it's interesting, because one of, you know, now that you mentioned that, one of the very first cases I ran across, first in terms of time, do you understand? So we're talking about late 2000, mm-hmm. was a woman in Australia, a Falun Gong practitioner, very well spoken, excellent English, kind of a high society girl, or how would I say it, sort of a princelingette, you know?
Okay.
Coming, you know, sort of well-connected, it seemed, and terribly well-educated, and she, I sat there in some sunny cafe in Australia talking to her, and she mentioned this exam. And when she mentioned this exam, it was a textbook, organs-only, retail organs-only exam, yes?
Mm-hmm.
And it was textbook. And I said, well, I listened to it all and waited and went through it all, and then I sort of said, do you think they were looking at your organs? And she said, oh, of course not. I was too important. You know, I was important.
Wow.
And she didn't quite say it that way. She didn't say, I'm too important. I don't want to, you know, misuse her words.
But then they would not be doing that to her.
No, not to her. No. No, not me.
Wow.
They wouldn't do that to me. And that did bring back, you know, the memories of, you know, throughout the Holocaust, that was often the belief of many Jews, was, you know, I'm a wealthy person, well-respected in the community, friends all over German society, and so forth. That's not going to happen.
Wow. Wow, that's incredible.
So I do think there is an interesting point there. I mean, this was not the Romani, for example, we did mention the gypsies earlier. The gypsies did not have that belief.
Mm-hmm.
They believed that anything was possible for them. But Falun Gong felt, you know, Falun Gong, as you know, was all over the society, and from, you know, peasants way out on the sticks to top universities and up in the Communist Party and in the military and so forth.
Well, I know you mentioned an interview with somebody you referred to as Minister X,
mm-hmm.
which, I mean, if I ever create a comic book character, that's his name.
Well, he really does look like that with the dark glasses and everything. Yeah, you know.
Really?
No.
You had me. Well, yeah, tell us about Minister X, because that was interesting.
Boy, did he hate my guts.
I can't imagine anyone not liking you.
He did not like
Ethan Goodman.
He did not like my first book very much. He thought it was
losing the New China.
New China. Yeah, he thought it was, you know, typical. I didn't understand China kind of thing. But that made for sort of an interesting interview because he was, you know, very confrontational. And so we sort of got into a kind of one of those weird interviews where you're sort of goading each other a little bit. And he did come out with this, you know, I think he had a very strange story. You know, if you start from the back, he basically defended or kept a worker, somebody who worked closely with him, out of prison or labor camp. She was Falun Gong. And he, I believe that's, and this is the one case where I think it's true. Usually, well, people will often tell a heroic story about how they left China, and it's often more complex than that, right? Life is more complex than that. But in this case, I had a feeling that that might well have been true, that he actually had a fairly secure and powerful position as a minister, and he lost it because he would not carry out the orders on Falun Gong.
Mm. Was he a Falun Gong practitioner or just a...
He certainly was not.
Okay.
But what he did was he... You know why his story struck me that way? That because he didn't tell it as if I'm a hero. He told it in complete irritation. he was so annoyed and angry about the whole thing. And, you know, he'd done something maybe that was significant or in some vague way a little heroic. And here's this idiot who's going to take it down and put it in his book. You know? That's sort of the impression he gave me. And so I put it in my book, you know. it is a sort of striking story. I mean, he did, you know, he was there. He saw the early persecution take place way before there was any kind of, it was even a gleam in most people in the Public Security Bureau's eye. I mean, this is back in 1995, 1996.
The official launch.
Way before the official launch of the persecution, years before. Mm-hmm. And already it seemed that there was a major plan afoot, and they were trying out various things, and they were going to take Li Hongzhi's book.
And the founder of Falun Gong.
The founder of Falun Gong. They were going to take his book. They were going to ban it. They were going to start ruining... You know, they were going to start ruining Falun Gong businesses. He wasn't supposed to give business licenses to Falun Gong practitioners. Mm. He was supposed to remove business licenses from those who had it. This is significant stuff. And it's all happening back in, as I remember, in 1995, late 1995, early 1996. That's when he gets the first red-headed document, as he calls it, a document which is, you know, it's like Mission Impossible. You're supposed to just see it and then destroy it, right? Mm. So that's why I've been, I don't want to get too sort of academic about this, but I've often had disagreements with people who all said, well, it all came down to Jiang Zemin and him suddenly feeling jealous and upset one day and having a big snit. I don't believe that. I believe this was a larger plan. Certainly started, I believe, with the Public Security Bureau, probably more than Jiang Zemin, and had been in, you know, there for a while.
That's always been kind of my take on it, too, yeah.
It's sort of systemic. Now, you know, people can make arguments both ways. But I do feel that one of the reasons it's easier to sort of put it all down to a single man and not a system. If you say, well, it's the mistake of a single man, that's pretty easy to move on, isn't it? Mm-hmm. But if it's the entire system, you really have a problem. And that's what I think the evidence suggests. Is this a systemic problem? This will happen again and again. In fact, and my new piece of evidence for that is what is now happening to the Uyghurs, because it's almost an exact carbon copy of what happened with Falun Gong, just speeded up.
Yeah, we just spoke to Matthew Robertson about that very topic.
Yeah, that's right. So it's now speeded up from 33 RPM to 78. Okay.
improving their persecution technology. I think that's how Matt Robertson put it.
Well, that's a very good way of putting it. It's amazing. And, of course, it's easier to do because Falun Gong was everywhere. Mm-hmm. And the Uyghurs are in a discrete area. Mm-hmm. So I think that's right. But at the same time, the speed which this has happened, that is, the people blood tested, then DNA tested, that started 18 months ago, as far as we know, or 19 or 20 months ago, right? Then they, you know, within that time, less than a year passes, and suddenly they've got 500,000 Uyghurs in labor camp, and now it appears that it's 1 million, if not more. Mm-hmm. You know, what was the figure of Falun Gong? And it, according to me, at least, at any given time, it was about 500,000 to 1 million at any given time. That's how many Falun Gong you had in incarcerated in one of the systems, right? Labor camp, black jails, long-term detention, you know, mental hospitals, and so forth. So this is the, this is making people's heads spin, and it should. But it's also true that anybody who's looked at the Falun Gong situation can see how dangerous this is.
I think not a lot of people looked at the Falun Gong situation, or at least there was some news about it in 1999 for a couple of years, and then
when
pretty much
started.
Died out, the reporting on Falun Gong.
The compassion fatigue with Falun Gong was really excessive. It's one of the stranger things in history, how quickly, how there just was complete loss of interest from most journalists. Now, it's also,
Well, I was going to say, even with the current persecution of the Uyghurs, like for me, I recognize that exact same thing. But a lot of people have been like surprised at it. Like, where did this come from?
Yeah, well, there is a tendency. I mean, let's not just make Falun Gong out to be the ultimate victim here. Look, there's a tendency to rediscover the wheel in all China reporting, okay? Mm-hmm. Every 3 years, you can practically set your watch by it. Maybe every 2 years, we go, oh my God, the Chinese have just taken all the Pentagon secrets or all of business's secrets or broken into all the human rights organizations in the world and stolen all their data. I mean, this happens every 2 years, right?
Oh, yeah, it's been happening for the entire history of the Communist Party.
Yeah, well, it's been happening. It's basically been happening ever since at least the internet became around, you know, 1999 or so. Yeah.
But the persecutions.
The persecutions, yes. And that's another repetitive thing. And then, of course, even for organ harvesting, for years, the BBC would report organ harvesting of prisoners every 3 years. And they'd say British women are putting the collagen of executed prisoners on their faces every night. As a beauty cream, and you could set your watch by it. Every 3 years, they'd come out with this story as if you've just forgotten about it and we just discovered it again.
Now, I'm shocked to find gambling happening here.
Exactly. So this was the first time, this year was the first time when the BBC finally reported, you know, said the magic word, prisoners of conscience, and started reporting on Falun Gong and Uyghurs being harvested for their organs. And it was it's kind of one of those really, really belated breakthroughs. Okay.
About time.
Well, so. I mean, you had talked about how you interviewed a woman who had had an organ exam, a Falun Gong woman who had an organ exam in 2000.
Yeah.
But I don't think I had ever heard of organ harvesting before 2006.
2006 is when I first heard about it. Yeah.
And it was still like a very fringe topic.
No, but I'm saying she was recounting events of 2000.
Right.
I didn't know about this.
Right. Yeah. I'm just wondering, like, why it took 6 years for that to kind of break through.
Well, there was a lot of one thing, and I don't mean to put it all, this is rotten, but I don't mean to put it all in the Falun Gong practitioner community, but there was a lot of denial about this issue. People were coming out of China, and one of the things Falun Gong did better than a lot of the other dissident groups was to debrief people very effectively. Okay, partly because they were worried about spies, people faking being a Falun Gong practitioner.
Which is a common tactic of the Communist Party.
Absolutely. They give them a whole story about how they were tortured and the rest of it. They, you know, and they can, and I've met one or two people who I'd say definitely were spies. Now, the fact is, though, that so Falun Gong was sensitive to debriefing people and to getting to know them and their story and so forth. But they were often talking about these, apparently about these exams, these strange physical exams, and also about people disappearing and so forth. And there was not a lot of interest, or there was a disbelief within the Falun Gong community itself that that could really be happening. And that's something really important to remember in these days of the tribunal, these days where it's starting to get common acceptance that this really has been going on now that Congress has kind of recognized it. And, you know, the UN hasn't, but that's for political reasons. You know, in this time, we have to remember how hard it is for people to accept this at first. Mm-hmm. It's very important for me to recognize that. I mean, I listen to questions and I just wonder, how can you even ask such a question? This is such a, you know, whatever. I don't want to get into the ins and outs of it, but I want to say that we have to remember how difficult this was, how science fiction it felt to people at first. And that even happened. There was a kind of denial within the Falun Gong practitioner community. There was a denial within the Uyghur community for many years. And certainly there's still a denial within the Tibetan community, in part because the Dalai Lama would still like to make an arrangement with China, right? That's his ultimate goal. He's been very clear about that. Mm-hmm. And if he accuses them of, you know, mass murder, it makes that deal much more difficult. And then for that matter, look at the Pope himself. I mean, he's gone to huge measures just to try to sweep this organ harvesting issue under the rug, or to say that China's reformed and they're a beacon to the world now in terms of transplants.
And they just abducted one of his bishops. So.
And they just abducted one of his bishops. Why did he want this deal? That I can't speak to, but it's interesting how much it's taken, how much effort people have put into the belief system here.
But you think it's very logical, right? Like the way the Communist Party of China started out is they would kill people and take their stuff. And this is like the logical extension of that. You kill people and take their internal organs.
Yeah, I mean, we're looking at, you know, you I'm sure, Chris, you've probably, I think I've seen one or two of your episodes on this thing, and you've talked about prices, right?
A lot of money.
It's a lot of money. I mean, I get estimates of if under ideal conditions, you could take every organ out and have somebody ready to take that organ, or a bunch of people, a room full of people ready to take your organs. At a certain point, you could have made about $225,000 U.S. dollars back in, say, 2003, 2004. After ECMO, after putting in the new techniques for lungs and transplants and preserving those organs, which make the logistics much easier, you can get up to $650,000 per person. Now we're talking real money.
Those are
foreign organ tourist prices, okay? The Chinese price is going to be more like, you know, $65,000 or $100,000, something like that, for all those organs. But nonetheless, I think that gives you some feeling of how this is truly lucrative.
And so what you're saying is that human life is very valuable.
It's extremely valuable. These people are extremely valuable. And it turns out I was wrong about a couple of things. I thought people who were 50, you know, their organs were not viable. That's just wrong. That's not true anymore. With the new techniques, you can get these things out. And, of course, where are they getting the techniques from? Well, Western doctors, democracies. That's our equipment that's going over there.
Jeez. Well, so I think that ties into the topic of what can be done about this. Before we get there, I was wondering if you could elucidate this. So what shocks me about organ harvesting in China is, one, the size of it, the size and scope, and also how they've managed to keep it quiet for so long, despite it being enormous. So, yeah, if you could explain, like, give us an idea of how big it is, and then why they've been able to keep that covered up.
Well, I mean, it is hard to estimate the exact size, but we can say that we are looking at about our study in 2016 said, this is me, David Kilgore, and David Maidis, put together this estimate, and we came up with an estimate of a range from 60,000 transplants per year to 100,000 transplants per year. Mm-hmm. Now, that gives you some feeling about how we're a little bit shooting in the dark here. Although, what's funny about that figure is that you can come up with that figure fairly easily, very quickly, from just looking at, you know, 165 hospitals, which are allowed to do this kind of transplantation, all have huge minimum requirements of how much staff and how many hospital beds they're supposed to have. And then the idea that they might be doing one a day, one transplant per day, right? And out of that, you're going to very quickly, you're going to be almost up, you're getting up to the 60,000 number very quickly. Now, it's actually not, that's the point about China. Everything's big, and so is the transplant industry. Now, I hasten to say that this 60,000 figure does not mean that 60,000 people are being killed. I mean, they might be getting three organs successfully out of each person, for all we know, maybe four. So we don't know. They might be just opening some people and finding a bunch of worms and saying, forget it, throw that body out. We don't know. So we can't come up with a casualty figure. But what is interesting is just in the last month and a half, Huang Zhefu, who is kind of the master of ceremonies for the Chinese, has basically embraced our numbers. He has announced, he said, we expect to reach 50,000 transplants per year by the year 2020.
So after and years of saying only 10,000, only 10,000.
Yes, now we're going to be at 50,000. Thank you very much, Huang Zhefu. It's great to be on the same page with you, because that's where we are. And you've got to admire the guy for
no, I don't.
You know, I meant for embracing. I mean, as a tactician. I mean, if we're tactically embracing a number like that, you know, talk about a way to sort of diffuse the issue.
Well,
I mean, it does make us more credible, but it also makes him. It's just like, well, that's not a big issue, is it? So what if
we're
doing 50,000 a year?
50,000, but is that? Is he saying that's because we now have so many donors, we can reach 50,000?
Oh, he's saying everything about it. He's saying, you know, we have so many great hospital facilities. Partly he's just bragging, which is what they like to do. Partly he's explaining so nobody can ever do the kind of study we did again. He's saying, you know, forget about transplant volume, guys. Fine. You know, we'll take it. And he is saying that there are so many voluntary donors, even though those are made up numbers.
Well, also you mentioned... So you were talking about how if you take, if you assume these hospitals are just doing one organ transplant a day, that's not even including the fact that they have been building mega centers for organ transplantation and that they've been building up the entire system.
No, that's correct. I mean, that's where you get to the 60, that's where you get over 50,000 into the 60,000 and up to the 100,000 range with just looking at a few of these big hospitals, Sun Yat-sen, Zhongshan Shanghai Hospital, and so forth. I mean, you can, Beijing 309 Military Hospital, you can get up to these figures very, very fast because these are, as you said, mega centers. Mm-hmm. And Tianjin Center as well. I mean, we even had a critical article from the Washington Post by a guy named Simon Denyer, a kind of an India hand who was transported over to China and tried to do a story debunking our report, and he clearly went over to Tianjin Central Hospital, which was sort of a centerpiece. Matt Robertson was the one who wrote this fantastic piece called A Hospital Built for Murder. It was one of the most important pieces written on this whole subject, which was claiming that Tianjin Central was doing over 5,000 transplants per year, mainly for foreign organ tourists. So this is a really profitable venture, right? What does Simon Denyer do? He goes over to Tianjin Central and hangs around like a good investigative reporter. Problem is, and I think this is where the Washington Post's editors forced him to write this little section, most of the people he saw waiting for organs were all foreign organ tourists. They were banned. In 2007, that's when the Chinese banned foreign organ tourism. It's been completely banned for all that period. But nonetheless, he couldn't find it even there, even in Tianjin Central, even though we've warned that hospital again and again. I mean, our stuff's been out for quite some time on this. Even then, they were still doing it. So I don't think, look, I think there is a tremendous confidence within the transplant system. And I believe from Huang Zhefu's perspective, they look at the Vatican signing a secret deal with China, and they say, we've got, you know, papal dispensation.
So how has this been so successfully covered up?
Well, I don't think it has actually been so successfully covered up. I mean, one of the points of our 2016 report was that it was so easy to get beyond the Chinese numbers. They were saying 10,000 per year, 10,000 per year. They were saying they said it 10 times in a row. Okay. And nonetheless, all it took was some dedicated researchers, mostly not me, okay, but some very dedicated Chinese researchers to go and just look at all the hospital websites and to look at things like Nurses Weekly and to search out some of the big stories that were in the Chinese press, because these doctors, particularly the ones who have been probably taking out, killing the most Falun Gong for their organs, are celebrities because they're very wealthy. They have very nice Facebook sites where they show off their calligraphy and their cars. Okay? And, you know, through that, you could start putting together a very strong picture. Not every hospital reported numbers, but a lot of them did. They weren't careful, and they were, and in fact, they had a tendency to brag. This is the weakness. They'd brag on the local level. And, you know, it's one of these best curry in town phenomena. I mean, there are five different hospitals which claim to do more liver transplants than anybody else in China.
But it was, so given, Ethan, given how easy it is to collect this data, and given that your book, The Slaughter, has been out for some time, and given the number of reports on this, why is there still so little attention given to this issue? Like, we're still doing business with a country where authorities are killing people for their organs. And even in the context of the trade war, we really haven't seen this come up.
That is true. And I think one of the Trump administration, again, without mentioning Trump, one of the Trump administration blind spots has been human rights. But America's hardly alone in that. Most people have been looking at the business of China. But it's not just the business. It is the medical world more than anyone else who has covered this up. Okay? It is the Transplantation Society. Now, they covered it up with the best of intentions. They covered it up like a true naive businessman coming to China would try to handle things. They come out, they're told to be really polite to their hosts, to be really very friendly, show them respect, and then, you know, but lay down a few simple rules and everything will work out. That is not true. No businessman in his right mind comes to China anymore and doesn't hire a fixer, okay? Doesn't hire some sort of Chinese consultant. That's madness to do that. But they did it. They came into China without any knowledge of human rights. They came without any knowledge of Chinese culture, without any understanding of Chinese law and the limits of Chinese law. Nothing. And they walked into that situation and said, we'll handle this. And now they're having a very hard time because they don't like to admit they were wrong.
And that they helped teach these techniques to people who may have been doing it.
In some cases, they did. These things all weigh into it. But the arrogance is the biggest problem here. The Kissinger syndrome, if you like. The inability to say, I was wrong. I misjudged this situation. There's something happening here I don't understand. This isn't just, you know, crude natives who do not know about Western ethics and the electric light bulb, okay? This is China. It's a really different situation. It's the Chinese Communist Party. It's something you don't understand. It's something the Pope doesn't understand. I'm not sure I even fully understand it, but the point is I know what I understand and what I don't. They didn't. And that is the worst point, because they have been, since 2012 to 2016, they dominated the discourse. And it was hard for us as well to impose. We wanted to give it a chance. Of course we did. We wanted to give reform a chance. We wanted the nice guy approach to give it a chance. We hoped it might work. It did not. And it became very clear that it was just offering a fig leaf to China.
Hmm. Sort of the old belief that if we engage with China, eventually the Chinese Communist Party will change.
That's exactly right. It's the same belief. 30 years later. It is the same belief that businessmen had, that politicians have many times have had, the lawyers, the legal profession, you know, often thought, well, we'll go in these legal exchanges, they'll learn from us, and then everything.
That's laughable.
And a new generation is born into this belief every time, right? Mm. And so we keep learning the same lesson. And the fact is, that's another problem, is the TTS has a rotating leadership basis.
Transportation Society.
Transplantation.
What did I say?
Transportation.
Excuse me. I'm trying to make it clear for the people listening, and I've just made everything worse.
I really thought you were making a reference to the transportation.
Well, believe me, riding the MTA is like pulling teeth, so that's only slightly different from pulling livers.
Oh, God.
Can't they speed up those escalators? Jeez, they used to go so nice and fast.
Hey, in Taiwan, I was amazed at how slow the escalators were.
You were?
Ridiculous. Yeah. Offended.
Well, I didn't use the... I tended to just run down the street most of the time.
Hands in the air screaming.
That's right. A bunch of girls running after me like the Beatles. Yeah, that's right.
I mean, can you blame them? Ethan Goodman.
The problem here is I'm afraid I wish I could say that this is all new and something, but I think this comes down to things we understand. This is there's a huge amount of prestige you get in the medical world from engaging with China. Okay, the Chinese are very eager to do it. They offer a lot of red carpet when you go there. It's got to be thrilling to people. I think I don't need to psychoanalyze anyone to understand this. I've talked to some of these doctors. I've talked to Francis Delmonico. I've talked to Jeremy Chapman. I get some sense of what they're doing, and they often feel that the Chinese are doing dangerous things. That is another problem, okay? That's where some of the involvement came in, that they're doing dangerous experimental things.
Gene-editing babies?
Well, you know, but hey, that guy disappeared. It's okay now. Good old China. I mean, it's all right now. We don't have to worry about it. He's disappeared from the scene. Yep. This is the problem here. And they're so eager for, new information and for... they're so eager to get into the medical conferences and to build their resumes by getting published in the medical journals and so forth. That's got to be extremely gratifying. It's a head trip. So I think there are a lot of different elements to this, and of course the ultimate one is money, because ultimately, usually involvement with China does involve a check of some kind at some point.
Yeah, it's funny. Like, the West has such a difficult time understanding the inner workings of China, and yet the Communist Party really understands the West very clearly. Just a check. That's all it takes.
In many cases, I think so. Though, we can't get much further on this tonight. I mean, this is going to be, this is one of the big failures, I feel like, of my life, was that period when we sort of waited for something to happen, some true reform to happen from the Chinese side, because the Transplantation Society was on it. Those were the wasted years. Hmm. That's tragic. Now, thank God we were doing some research on the side, so we were able to, once we decided that's enough, I think we have to go harder now. I mean, I think this is, that period is really over. I think it's time to, when we see cooperation with Chinese surgeons, when we see them being, coming to conferences, when we see new techniques being brought into China, I think we really have to stop it. I mean, I'm not saying the barn door wasn't open a long time ago. Of course it was. But it's important to call wherever we see cooperation or complicity with Chinese aims in organ transplantation, we have to now stop it and call it. I think that's particularly important in Asia. I think that's going to be, it's been important in Taiwan now for half a year. It's going to be very important in South Korea and Japan.
Do you think that there could be enough external pressure put on this transplantation system in China that they would stop taking organs from prisoners of conscience?
Me and David Matus have argued about this for a couple of years. He's often said, there's no point in going after organ tourism, really, Ethan. It just makes people feel better. And I said, well, there's an advantage to that in cleaning your hands. Yes, that's a good thing. But I think it goes further. Right now, we could say that suppose organ tourism really did stop from Japan. Suppose it was really banned. Taiwan has banned it, essentially, this year for the first time. I mean, they said it before, but now they're actually coming out. The Ministry of Health is saying 9,000 Taiwanese have gone to the mainland for organs. Now, after this, if they come back and they've gone to the mainland, they will not get their anti-rejection drugs paid for anymore. Okay, that's $500 a month extra. Now, that's a regressive tax. I understand wealthy people, $500 is no big deal. But for them, that's a big deal, right, for most people. And I believe that can really can make a real difference. Now, imagine if that happened in Japan and South Korea. Well, then you're really starting to cut into the profit. For the first time, you're affecting things. You are affecting the economics of the situation. So I do believe that that can happen. And it's not outside the possibilities of, and besides that, along with it, if you see people losing their medical, a few people, it doesn't have to be a lot, but if you see a few stupid show trials where some doctors, Japanese and South Korean doctors, lose their medical licenses for acting as organ brokers, I don't think that would be a bad thing. I think that would be a good thing. I think that's good for the medical profession. It's probably not, probably a lot of people won't get charged. But this complicity has fed, this is, the killing is partially based on this, on the money coming in, partially.
Israel has also banned that, right?
They were the first country to do so. I think back in 2008, that was mainly through a man named Jacob Levy, a heart surgeon, who, he has particular power in Israel. He's a great guy, and he's a very good speaker. But he also, his parents both came out of the camps. And so he has a certain moral authority, and he was able to build a coalition, and they very quickly at least stopped paying for people to go to China through the HMO system. So that was significant. Italy's banned, Spain is banned, Taiwan, at least on paper, has banned, and now maybe in real practice. And we'd certainly like to see, we're hoping for Czech to ban. They're talking about it now, I think, quite seriously. We'll see. Well, obviously, the countries who'd like to see it would be UK, US, Canada, and Australia. But the biggest countries and the most important by far are Japan and South Korea.
In terms of real impact on the economy of the system.
Yeah, that's right. Now, I'm not saying we can control Dubai, okay? We can't stop that. We just don't have the influence there to stop. So we can't hit the rich Gulf states. You'll still get those organ tourists. But if Japan, that's possible, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it will require the one thing the Japanese claim they never want to do, which is some loss of face, and they'll be embarrassing because things will be revealed. So I think this is where things, I believe, this is, I'm an advocate of, this is where things have to go. We must take a bit of a harder stance. It's also true that every time you do this, the news media jumps. Okay? So anytime there's an actual connection to your country, one of your companies, one of your doctors, that's when things get interesting for the news media. And that increases the awareness of this organ harvesting problem, which is otherwise just these faraway people, right?
Yeah.
So I know that sounds cynical to use it that way, but I don't think it's cynical. I mean, I think we do play into these things, and we have for too many years. So that would be my argument going forward. I think we'll be seeing some interesting things developing. I don't think it's just, drug companies and so forth. There are architectural firms involved in these kinds of things, big ones from the West. And I'll be trying to investigate that stuff over the next year.
Great. Well, since we're getting probably a little short on time, one final question I'd like to ask is, this has kind of come up over the course of this discussion, just sort of this almost like karmic wheel where the same things keep happening again and again and again, and no one ever really does anything. And since you mentioned you've been doing this fight for so long and haven't necessarily seen it come to an end, how do you encourage the next generation to fight the good fight, to be a good man?
I have seen that happen without me doing anything. I mean, if there's anything that reassures me, you said the magic words, Matt Robertson, he probably doesn't like to see himself as a young man compared to me, but he is, okay? he is. He's a lot younger than me. And I'm not going to, I'm 60 years old. I'm not going to live that long. I'm, you know, whatever. You know, I look at somebody like him, or really, you know, somebody who's young and is really, you know, speaks the language, has really got his chops in this thing. Yeah, that gives me a lot of faith for the future. I see young activists. I see people coming out with, I didn't think so highly of the maybe the early films by, what's his name? The guy did Human Harvest. Help me out with his name here. Leon Lee. But I haven't seen his recent film, A Letter from Masinja, the one he did with Caleb Ford, but it's getting really good reviews, right?
I saw good.
He's coming of age as a director. This is great, okay? This is the stuff that I see. So I don't think it's a question of me saying that. I think the biggest inspiration I could be is if I can continue to do this, if I can make a living doing this, doing this kind of work. I think that would be really helpful to everybody. It would show that, that there is a way to move forward. That's something I've had to think about over the past year. And over the past year, I was thinking about going in a different direction. My wife was saying, you've done this issue long enough. And then I woke up one day and said, why have I been doing this issue long enough? I haven't. They're still doing it. Mm. I want to get back in that fight. And that's where I'm at. And this is where I'm going to stay. As long as they're playing, I'm playing. If they want to, you know, if they want to switch, if we're playing polo right now, they want to switch to badminton, okay, then maybe I'll quit. Okay. But right now, you know, this is where it's at. This is the game. And I don't feel like I owe anybody anything anymore, but I want to be in this now. And I'm really happy to see people making this issue their own. I really am.
Ethan, you truly are a good man.
Well, thank you very much. You too, Chris. You're the best. Best on the podcast world right now. That's it. With a bullet. Okay.
What does that mean?
Oh, talent on loan from God. I don't know. What do you say in these cases?
I don't know. Thank you so much for joining us today, Ethan. If somebody wanted to learn more about you or what you're doing or about organ harvesting, where should they go?
End Transplant Abuse in China. It's the just go to the website. This is the coalition that I'm a co-founder of it. It's really doing great work. There are other places to go as well. There are all kinds of local movements building on this thing, like, for example, Bristol Against Forced Organ Harvesting, which has been, you know, on the front pages of the Bristol News, okay? But that's a big deal. And also you can look at my book, The Slaughter. It's a good read. It was, you know, it came out in 2014. It's still getting translated into new languages all the time.
Hi, Beckett.
Yeah, okay.
So does Shelley.
But get the Kindle edition because it's the only way I make any money. Okay.
Everyone buy the Kindle edition.
Okay, not the used hardcover. No good. Okay, thank you very much. Cheers.
All right, thank you for joining us. Okay. And for all you listening, don't forget to check us out on ChinaUnscripted.com. And again, leave us a positive review on iTunes. Once again, I'm Chris Chappell.
I'm Shelley Zhang.
And I'm Matt Ganeshda.
Talk to you next time.